Hi, I'm Christopher Cassiopo. I'm 48 years old. Today's date is Thursday, February 11th, 2021. I'm currently in Wellington, Florida, and I'm here with my mom and my dad, Sue and Mike.
Oh, Mike Cassiopo. I'm 77 years old, born in 1943.
Today's date?
Today's date is the same as Chris's date, I think. Thursday, the 11th, 2021.
Where are you?
I'm in Wellington, Florida.
Who are you here with?
I'm here with my wife, Susan, my son, Christopher, and myself.
Hi there. I'm Sue Cassiopo. I'm 77 years old. Today's date is Thursday, February 11th, 2021. We're currently in Wellington, Florida. I have two partners here, my husband, Mike, my son, Chris.
You win. Okay.
I win.
So I always talk to my friends, and one of the things that's like most interesting to them is that you guys met in the Lunar Lander project, the Apollo project. And so I think the most important thing you did there is meet each other, otherwise it wouldn't be here. But I kind of want to talk to you about some of the projects. So if I start with Sue, what did you do on the Apollo project?
I was responsible for doing software that essentially graphed all the data that we were getting for the lunar project. The LEM, the Lunar Excursion Module, that has recently been changed to the Lunar Module.
What was that?
They thought it was a lemon, and so they changed it to Lunar Module instead of Lunar Excursion Module, which we all think of it as anyway, because that's the way it was. And so because there was so much data coming out of the testing for the space project, and in particular the LEM, we had to find a way of getting it better. And my initial project, and which lasted a long time, was to graph all of it through special equipment, which was specially built for us, and through at the time, a large control data computer.
What was your work there?
Well, what I was doing was working, getting data collections and reduction for the ascent, descent, reaction control system engines, the electrical engines, the reaction, the navigation and guidance systems. And right now, that's all I remember.
So let's talk a little about the computers there. So today we all have this amazing phones in our pockets that are incredibly powerful. Can you tell me about what it was like when you first, computers were new at the time. What was it like when you first got access to these giant room-sized computers?
Well, the first time they introduced me to the computer, I knew about programming, but I didn't know about this computer. And so it literally filled a room. It had very little power compared to what we have today. 4K of memory was in this beautiful box that was about 3 feet wide and 6 feet tall and had beautiful doors on it. And it was all a 4K of memory. It was 4K of, 32 bytes? I think it was 32 bits. So, and we thought it was wonderful. So the first time they took me in there, they said, here it is. And everybody walked away. And I was out of school for a couple of months, and this was a bit shocking. Here is your personal computer. And actually, it acted like my personal computer for quite some time because it had a wonderful table that we could work at that was part of the computer system. But it was a bit intimidating because we had the computer in there, and we had my graphing equipment in there and a lot of analog equipment also in the same facility, as well as some workspace. So it was a tremendous room and somewhat intimidated to somebody newly out of college.
So we kind of live in this world of data at this point where there's just so much. I mean, everybody has photos or megabytes or gigabytes. But when you guys started this, data was mostly captured in notebooks before this. The first time it was like large data collection. Can you talk a little, Daddy, about what it was like to work with some of the older engineers? Oh, that kind of look jokingly. Of what it was like to work with the older engineers that were used to getting notebooks. You had a particularly interesting story about that I always loved as a kid.
Well, what happens is, when you say old engineers, they're probably 30. I was like 21, 22, somewhere in that ballpark. And one of the thermal engineers wanted some reduction of some thermal data, which was during a dry test on the system, the lunar module. And the instrumentation people didn't understand too much either. They sampled temperatures at 100 samples a second, which obviously doesn't change too much. And they put a lot of thermal sensors in so they could understand what was happening rather than deduce what's happening based on other samples. But anyway, we had like an hour run, and this engineer says, I want all the data. I said, okay, we'll average it for you, and we'll give you the max and mins and stuff like that with the software. He says, no, I don't trust you guys. I don't trust software. I want every data point in my thermal data. I said, you sure all of it? He says, yeah, all of it. I said, okay. So we give the tape to the facility 7040, I think it was 7094 IBM computer, and I submit the request and I go away. About 3 hours later, the operator calls up and says, you sure you want all this data coming out? I says, how much do you got? He says, I got tons of it. He's like, I got boxes and boxes of stuff, and I'm only a third of the way there. I said, tell you what, kill the job. Don't worry about it. Appreciate it very much. So I find out how many boxes. There's probably like 7-8 boxes that are probably, I don't know, about 2.5 feet tall by the old standard computer paper was, I guess, about 30 inches wide or 20 some odd inches wide, yeah. Whatever. And I get some help. And we deliver it to him at his desk. We fill his whole desk up and the floor around his place with data. He says, what the hell is this? I says, it's data. It's only a third of it. Do you want the rest? He says, what are you talking about? He grabs a handful, and the temperature hasn't changed, obviously. So from then on, he was willing to believe that we could reduce the data by giving the max, min, average, whatever he wanted, and never ask for all the data again.
It's just a very different change in life. Like today, people are used to it. But even today, I think it's interesting that that's in a different scale, but it's still a problem today. So I think you're one of my role models how I manage people when Susie. But I think it's very interesting that in today's day and age, like there's still less women than men in engineering, but women in engineering are not uncommon. You were kind of a lone woman in like this male field. Like, what was it like to work with surrounded by men at that point?
Less comfortable than it probably would be today, because the women's lib had just barely started, and men thought they could do what they wanted, and they also didn't think women were as competent, and so there was an attitude about women. I was not in the engineering field per se. I was in software, which was a brand new field. You couldn't get a degree in computer software or engineering, whatever. You could no computer stuff. And so they just took anybody. So there was actually one other woman in the computer area. But because it was a new field, there were, quote, more women, which meant practically none, but certainly better than the engineering field, which had none. And you sort of always making your way through this strange field where men didn't think you belonged there. But I was just very lucky because I was good at what I did, and what I did was very important then. So that was a good fortune. And so eventually I could get people convinced, at least the people I worked with all the time, that I knew what I was doing. If you've got a new person in, a new man, you'd have to start all over again.
That's kind of terrible enough.
Well, nobody was getting up. Well, I didn't get upset about this type of thing. It's just the way it was. I didn't know there was any other option. So sort of like when we worked on the lunar project, which we had to do things that people had never done before, we were young, we didn't know any better, so we just did it.
So that's a great transition. You guys were right out of school, and then someone gave you a project of helping us land on the moon. That sounds crazy. What did you guys think at the time? I don't know, Dad?
Well, it's kind of funny, is as much as didn't know any better, we thought this is what engineers did. I mean, you know, you break ground, you make new things.
You land on the moon?
And you land on the moon, yes. So it's really hard to comprehend. I wasn't wowed or anything like that. It's just this is what we did. And everybody around me did the same thing. So, like, that's like normal, isn't it? But later on, as you look back, you realize that it wasn't normal, but that's now and not then.
And you mentioned about the adult supervision there was how old?
Oh, if you were in the engineering, you were probably under 25. If you were management, you were at least 30, 35.
We had your manager, I believe, was 28.
Yeah.
Jerry. And
but he's lower management.
Well, that was the highest we saw. And then we had one gentleman who was 31, mm-hmm. and I think the other one was 33. And those are the old guys. I mean, they looked really old to us because we were 21, 22. They were old and very experienced. So we thought.
Nobody landed on the moon.
No. Yes, so nobody really knew how this was done.
That's really interesting. So, like, you just assume it was going to work? Did you guys not think it was going to work? Like, how do you do that? Like, people's lives are not only alive and aligned, because a lot of people do think that people's lives are aligned. Lives are aligned, and the entire world is going to watch what happened. So,
well, one of the things is changing the subject slightly. Everything on Apollo was quad redundant, and you had a regulator. The regulator had four regulators inside of it. Any one of the regulators failed, the others would take over. If all three of them failed, you still had another. If the fourth one failed, you had another route to get the same gas through the system. So it was more than quad redundant. I was very upset when the Three Mile Island had a relay that didn't work. I'm saying a relay, and you're working with nuclear energy. It was very confusing to me.
I think that we just ran ahead and decided it would work. Clearly, the people who were 21 and 22 were not the ones designing this project. We were processing data. We were doing things that other people didn't know how to do. Clearly, the people who designed the quad redundancy for all these systems were not the 21 and 22-year-old people. So I think we sort of expected that somebody knew what they was doing, putting together the overall design of the system, and we just kept running, and we expected it to work. After all, we were testing it, and things seemed to be going okay, but we were pretty young.
So today, like, there's millions and millions of people to program. Back then, there wasn't so much. I remember as a kid playing with punch cards that we used for all sorts of arts and crafts projects. I don't remember why. But can you talk a little about programming a computer? Like, what was it like to program a computer when pretty much nobody programmed computers?
Well, it's not the fact that nobody did. The nobody did problem came up with you couldn't hire programmers. You couldn't go and put an ad out and get programmers. What you did is you put out an ad and you got some people. I mean, they took biology majors, English majors. They took everybody because there were no programmers. So either people took to it or they didn't. And you got rid of the ones that didn't and you kept the other ones. But to do programming now, people just sort of type away on their computer and things happen. But when I was programming, the first thing you had to write your program out. And you may initially put it on a scratch pad. But then there were these very large pieces of paper. Maybe they were 18 inches wide and 12 inches high. And they had 80 little columns in each space. And you had to write down your program in the proper spaces. And when you were finished writing all this stuff down tediously, you had to pick it up and deliver to the key punch people. The key punch people would then read all these little scratch marks you put in, all these programming stuff, and they would punch it onto these punch cards that Chris was just talking about. So what we did, so now we have a bunch of punch cards, And if the punch cards could be 1 inch of punch card, you could have, you know, 6 inches of punch cards. And the punch cards would then be submitted as a job to the computer, which was this humongous computer in a room, a different one that I spoke about earlier. This was an IBM 7094. They would go into stacks where everybody else who was submitting jobs were. The computer operator would take this pile of cards and hopefully keep it together because they needed to be in order. And remember, there's many cards that could fall all over. And then he'd put them into the card reader of the computer. And he would then tell the computer to run a job. And the card reader, trying to make it read-write, was very loud because it would jump around and make so the cards were all level and they'd all feed. And then the job would run, and then paper was produced, computer paper, and eventually somebody delivered that to my desk where I went and picked it up. So now when you program anything, you program PCs, you write it in, you run it, and you're done, and you do it again. My turnaround was probably 24 hours every time, unless I was extremely lucky that I could get it done in an 8-hour shift. So this is the way it worked.
It was a CDC 3200 computer. You said IBM.
It was an IBM 7094 that I programmed like that.
Oh, okay.
The 3200 I programmed differently.
Okay.
Interesting. And so when you looked at stuff, so you're doing a lot of thrust and such. And I remember vividly, and it was probably like 20 years ago, I was at the Smithsonian, and there was the lunar module in front of me. And I called you up on the phone. I was like, Dad, I'm sitting in front of a lunar module in the Smithsonian. And then you managed to walk through from memory, which you probably looked at for 30, 40 years, whatever it was at that point, of like what every antenna did and everything. Like you just, I walk around and you had a mental picture in your head. Like how did that, like, how did you, it was just amazing.
Well, we had a mock-up of the lunar module sitting very close to the high bay area. And actually you could climb into it if you wanted to. It had covered with gold foil. And it's funny as much, a lot of holes were still not filled with gauges and stuff because parts were on order and being developed and whatnot. But everything was there. It had no more processing power than maybe the original AT computer, if that. It was mostly manual. They had three little windows or four little windows, I'm not sure which one. And that's what they had to look at. They had radar and stuff, but it's just amazing that we saw it every day. I mean, it's like, and you see the Smithsonian, you say, wow, that's just like the one we have.
That's what everyone says. clearly. So let me sort of jump forward a little bit. I know you guys left Grumman Aircraft before this, but when Apollo 11 launched, how did you feel? Like all of a sudden we built this thing that's gonna land on the moon and it's taking off and the whole world's looking, you're like, yeah, it's gonna get there. Like, or like, oh my God, it's gonna work. Like, how did you guys feel?
No, I really didn't think it was not gonna work. I mean, we tested everything. We did drop testing at Bethpage. That's where Grumman main headquarters were, basically. We did electrical 3-4 day tests to see how the electrical system was going to work. We did not guidance and navigation simulations up the yin yang, and everything was tested many, many, many times, and everything was closely checked by NASA to make sure that, you know, the data was correct. So I said, wow, this is going to happen. We're going to see him land on the moon. The biggest problem we had was we didn't know how thick the dust was on the moon. That was a guess. And basically the guy who guessed it correctly was says, hey, it's like cinders, I guess, from coal burning and stuff. That's exactly what it was. They only went down a couple of inches.
Actually, I remember a story you told me a while back about meeting some of the astronauts. When you were doing stuff and showing them how some safety valve works and how brilliant they were.
If I can, okay. There's a couple of instances. I originally thought, like everybody else, that these astronauts were basically, you know, daredevil jocks. That's basically what they were. They're very intelligent. They risked their lives. They flew airplanes real fast and untested. And I was amazingly alerted that that was not the case. Case in point, during a lecture with some of the, I forget astronauts' names, I'm sorry about that, but during one of the lectures, a friend of mine was describing how the lock door on the lunar module worked, you know, how a mechanism worked, how it latched and everything else. And one of the astronauts says, no, it doesn't. And not to be rude, my friend says, yeah, I hate to differ with you. I designed it. He says, no, it doesn't work that way. He says, I don't know how to tell you without being rude. It does. It works that way. I designed it. He says, no, it really does. He says, sir, without trying to insult you or anything, it does. He says, no, wrong. It no longer works that way. He says, what do you mean? He says, look at this scenario. And he gave a scenario that was so subtle that almost no one would pick it up. This is the first time this guy saw this whole thing. And it was a case that, hey, I could be on the outside, it could latch and lock, and I can't get in, and there's no one home. I think we should change that immediately to this kind of fix. And it was amazing, he did it. Another one was, I'm trying to think of which one was a, well, there's one was, they were in an environmental chamber testing the suits. And one thing about when you're doing environmental tests with humans is that when the test was on, there was an ambulance with a driver in it with the engine running right outside the facility. Right outside the test area, there was an operatory. So you could go in and do any kind of surgery you needed, massage the heart or whatever it was, and it was physicians available on the spot. Meanwhile, in this chamber, you have like four or five physicians watching everything and a whole bunch of engineers doing all the testing. And this engineer and the astronaut says, you know, it's pretty hot in this suit, and the suits weren't really developed that well at that time. He says, I'm going to take my helmet off. He says, no, we got like another 50 pages before you can do that. He says, no, I trust you guys. What's the atmosphere out there? He says, fine, blah, 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 blah. He says, I'm taking my helmet off. No. He took it off. He says, ah, it's much better. It's not cooler in here now. A third one was, I just had it in this reality already.
I think this is old age showing up.
Yeah, it's old age showing up.
Did you ever meet the astronauts?
I never met the astronauts.
Oh, I'm trying to think. Electrical. I'll come back to it. How's that?
Really good. Okay. So there's land on the moon, which is kind of scarier than they blast off and whatnot. But there's another interesting situation where I think Apollo 13, where they had a problem with their oxygen regulator. And they life support didn't work in the command module, and then they decided they were going to come back in the lunar module, which I know was entirely, you did all your testing for stuff, was totally not intended for that. How did you guys feel in that case? You're like, they're misusing what we have, and people's lives are on the line. I don't know. What do you guys think?
First of all, I think it was a micrometeorite that hit it. And it caused damage, I think, to the batteries. I'm not sure. I forget at this point in time. As I said, everything was quad redundant. So there was really hefty engineering that went into this. And it wasn't designed to support the three people coming back. And if I remember correctly, they had to figure out some air filtration system modifications with parts they had on board, which weren't spare parts by any stretch of the imagination, and it did with ground support.
So this is very typical. How did you feel?
How did I feel?
Yeah.
I thought they'd make it back. I really did. I was very
really
optimistic.
Correct.
I was in this whole program. I was very optimistic. Everything was going to go all right. Sorry.
How about you, Susie?
I think at the time it was a little bit stressful, but I think that underneath, I thought they were going to make it back because so much work had been done on it. My concern was, how do you get back? The module that was coming back is not supposed to come back with a limb attached to it. So that to me seemed very strange, and how are they going to do that? I really was impressed by the engineering that was done so quickly to decide how to support these guys in the LEM and then transfer them. I thought that was amazing.
I remember it, my other.
You do remember, go for it.
To give you an idea of what kind of people these astronauts were, another guy was a friend of mine again, was saying how the manifold oxygen supplies work for the Commodore and the captain, commander and the captain. And one of the astronauts says, hey, is that a common manifold? He says, what do you mean by that? He says, if my suit rips, am I bleeding down both systems? He says, there's only one of them, and yeah, he's losing oxygen too. So he says, well, then your suggestion is I should do a quick disconnect. He says, yeah, you'll completely shut off your air supply. His will be fine. He says, okay. Let's see, I got to hold my breath for the Scott air packs are back there. I can do it. Okay, keep going. I mean, when they realize that they have a danger and it's no way of changing that danger, they're great. They were really brave and very intelligent people.
Well, they had to have done that to, in the stressful conditions of Apollo 13 coming back, and then they had to do all of the modifications required. They had to be pretty cool under a lot of pressure. I mean, this is literally life and death.
So let's transition to the most important part of the lunar project. How did you guys meet? Because clearly that's what caused me to happen.
Okay, so what happened? Let's see. We were in this great, great big area that used to be supporting aircraft during World War II. And the group that Michael was in was on one side. Just desks.
Trailers.
No, long before the trailers. But a bunch of desks. And then the group that I was in was on the other side of the aisle, which was made up by the desks over here and the desks over there. There was just big open space. And I think he was just watching the only young women that were over there. He didn't have a lot of choice. Well, there weren't a lot of young women to look at, or any women for that matter.
If I wasn't straight, I'd have a lot more choices, but...
That's correct.
Yeah, so...
No, Maybe not.
We interfaced because a lot of the software requirements programming that I needed, Sue would be able to do to reduce the data that I was collecting, and we interfaced quite a bit. And we disagreed a lot, but we interfaced quite a bit.
Well, that is true, because data engineering had the requirements, and the software people did the work to make those requirements happen. So when the data engineering people like Michael decided that they needed the data processed like this, whatever this was, then they would make a request to the group that I work for, which, you know, right against the aisle, so we talked a lot, to do the software so that it would happen. So, I didn't decide what would happen. The engineers like Michael would decide what would happen in the software.
So there's a lot of men probably there that were with very few women. So
correct.
You probably get asked that a lot.
It was not hard to do.
So why did you pick him?
I have no idea. I'm still asking myself, why did I pick him, you know, 60 years ago, whatever it was. I guess it's only 55 years ago.
What do you remember from him? Like, what was the things that initially attracted you?
Oh, he was very, very persistent. He had a persistence that things that wouldn't be allowed in today's businesses, because you can't ask somebody out and then keep pestering them. So, because that's not allowed today, a lot of things are. And during my first training on sexual sensitivity or whatever it was, my comment was, I wouldn't be married today if that persistent was illegal and was reportable. But he was very persistent. But we were young and going out all the time, too. And we're in proximity. You get to know somebody better when you're working with them all the time. Not that it's always the best thing to do to date people that you live with, but, you know, it's the way it works.
Maybe good or bad. It worked out for me.
It worked out for you. It worked out for me too.
That's good. What do you remember?
What I remember about what, dating or what?
About her, dating her.
Oh, yeah.
That's what
he remembers. She was very naive and stuff in as much as she didn't understand some of the words that were running around. But then it was funny.
Yeah, they used to laugh at me a lot.
They used to laugh a lot. But she had a good personality, and we ended up dating, and then we ended up getting married.
And having two kids. One of them's you.
Yeah, I appreciate that part. Who is there anyone else in the Lunar Project that any other people that really stood out to you of amazing people you worked with or amazing people you saw, like that really were inspiring?
Yes. I was really impressed with the 31-year-old manager, Tony Joseph. Yeah. He was a great guy. He's a really brilliant guy. He could do hardware and software. And there were times when some of the equipment wasn't working right. And he was originally my manager and our friend. But I can remember times when things weren't working right. And he'd go, well, should we change the software? And sometimes he'd just go and, because the hardware could be managed, you could rewire things, because things were wired then. They weren't all on chips. You know, the chips sets were, well, they weren't even chips like we know it today. So they were wiring. And I can remember sometime going in and saying, oh, I'm just going to change it this way. And that to me is like magic, because I can't do that. And he was just brilliant about all sorts of things. But he was so old because he was 31.
How about you?
Same person. Tony was very sharp. He had a photographic memory. And the funny part was people would say, I'm going to take a vacation down in Bahama or whatever. And he says, it's a great place. He goes diving. You can't miss it. He's like, he knew everything about everywhere.
And he was 31. I don't know what he did. His wife had money, so I think he was more traveled than most of us, because, again, we're 20, 21, 22, 23.
He never cashed his checks.
Yeah.
They used to call up, the controller to call him up and says, Tony, could you please cash your checks? We want to close out the quarter.
The other thing that makes somebody good like that is he loved what he did. Yeah. I think that's the important part. If you really like what you do, you're really good at it. You know, assuming
you guys like what you did?
Yes. I always liked what I did.
Yeah, I had fun.
Yeah, I had great fun. It was the most amazing thing, because programming to me is one puzzle after another. You solve one. The trouble is you solve one and then it's gone and you just got to go to the next one. So there's a never-ending series of puzzles to be solved. And so to me, it was fun. I never was not wanting to work there. I thought it was just great fun. But then again, I thought this was fun for my entire career. So
how'd you get this job?
Not the way normal people do, I guess. I got out of school and I had a degree in theoretical mathematics, which is not really useful for a lot of stuff. It turned out it was very useful for software development. And so my father had a friend who was the one of the vice presidents of Grumman Aircraft, which was doing the LEN. And he says, oh, my daughter's getting out of school. Can you get her a job? And so he got me a couple of interviews. And then when it was finished, I'm going, okay, they all want me, but they all want me because this is not really the way you're supposed to get a job. Well, I guess it is the way. It worked. And so I called this gentleman up and I asked him, what do you think would be the best job to have? And he told me the one in flight test, which was this particular area for the project, the Lunar Project. So I took that one. And I had a great time there. I was never unhappy about being there.
How'd you get the job? Or why'd you get the job?
I needed work. No, I just graduated out of Brooklyn Poly. And it was hiring like crazy. I mean, Grumman started at Bethpage. I don't mean thousands of people. But at its peak, I think it was 35,000 people. It was a small company at first. A great company, but a small company. And they were just, as long as you were warm, you could get a job. And
I guess I should have, I didn't know
you
that.
Went, you could have went through the front door.
I could have gone through the front door and had the same job.
Yeah, but that's what it was.
They weren't that small. They did make a lot of fighter jets for
Oh.
They made a lot of the fighter jets for World War II.
F-111s.
And they made the A-6As. Vietnam.
A-6As yeah. and F-111As and Bs.
That was their bread and butter.
But that wasn't, we were in flight test, and believe it or not, flight test didn't include those aircraft.
Yes, it included the Lunar Project.
And the Lunar Project had called LEM Data Reduction Station. It was probably one of the highest tech stations available at the time. They spent millions of dollars, which wasn't so much today, but millions of dollars then for the best equipment for computers, for tape decks, for analog playbacks, digital playbacks, you name it, that was it. It was the state-of-the-art devices.
And that was a day when all the data was on reels of tape.
Yeah, half-inch tape.
So like you see in the old movies. So everything was on reels of tape, and everybody's putting tapes on and taking them off and putting them on and taking them off. And you'd have to process through the whole damn tape.
Yeah, so, everything was read linearly. What I mean by that is that you get an analog tape, you run it through the analog equipment to go digital. Now you've made a computer tape, which nothing but bits on it, basically. You had to mount that on a computer. The program had to read what was there and analyze it. And then you could get something of a hard copy. There was no intermediate, here's a thumb drive.
Yeah.
So one thing I thought was always very interesting is, you talk a bunch of, there was a welfare department in Grumman Aircraft.
Oh.
Which is really interesting. And I think companies go up and up and down while they take care of people, but it sounded like an amazing place to work.
But every place had a welfare, every building had a welfare department. And what that was is Grumman's smart way of saving money and making people happy.
And keeping out the unions that
and
were
keeping out
it.
The unions. What it was is that, for example, in New York, every year you have to renew your license plates. So with 35,000 people, you got quite a few thousand people have to go to the motor vehicle department each month. But what you did was you made a check, you clipped it to your paperwork, and you handed it in to the welfare department. Now they would have a kid, and I say kid's probably 18 years old, he would drive down, go in the back door of the department and get them all fixed and filled out by the time that you came back. So at the end of the day, you go there, there's your license plate. Another thing is you break your leg. Well, you can't drive to work. Well, yeah, you can if you have this kid pick you up in the morning. The kid would pick you up in the morning. He'd drive you to work. He would do other tasks like run a bus between buildings and stuff like that during the day or whatever else he had to do. Then when if you worked overtime, he worked overtime and he drove you home. If you wanted to borrow tools, you could borrow tools, and as long as you brought them back. So you can get some high-class tools to fix your buildings at home. It had discounts, and anything they could get discounts on. They would buy commercial, like if someone wanted a Corvette engine, for example. They could go to the purchasing department, say, I want a Corvette engine and from General Motors. And we have to identify exactly what it was. And General Motors, then Grumman would order it under their PO. It would come in, they would pick it up at the airport, it would come in, they would notify you that it was in, you filled out a check and gave them the price that they pay for it without shipping and handling and all that stuff because Grumman took care of that. They'd loan you a truck, a Grumman truck, so you could drive it home and then return the truck the next day.
I think in general, I did know the person who was in charge of that stuff, same guy who got me the job, and the intent was all of the companies around were all unionized, and what they decided is that they could keep people better than having them in unions by giving them all the services they needed, and more so. I mean, people would go there during tax time. And if they didn't know how to fill out their taxes, they would take care of that. So you could just go to welfare and ask for help, and they would do their best to help you in all sorts of ways. So, and this was a way of keeping the unions out. Who would want a union if you had the welfare department? And every time there was a union raise in the local area for these type of companies, the people at a certain level would get, I think at the hourly level, would get a raise with it. So people had no reason for unions because they got such good service from the company. I mean, my roommate actually was sick once, and it took a while for her to be, she wasn't sick, she was damaged, I forgot how. And they would come pick her up every day and bring her home. Yeah, it was just like amazing. And one time she got sick at work, and she was carpooling with me, and so they sent somebody and they took her to the doctor. They drove her all the way back to her doctor. And I mean, it was just a really good service. It was a really good idea. Not very much done now, but I'm not sure that it wouldn't be a good idea again.
Well, before COVID, we all get really good snacks in the office.
That's, yes, that's we all got lots of food.
The same thing. But so do you want to wrap this up? We out of time? So of all the things you guys have done, like on a little project, like what was the thing that you guys were most excited about? Like what was the thing that you were most proud of yourself? Like, I did this. Getting to the moon is not the right answer. I mean, it might be, but what did you guys do? What are you most proud of? You look back and like, or what's the most amazing thing you look back? Like, what is the thing that like you really remember? Too old, huh?
I don't know that I got excited about a lot of it. I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed my digital equipment that I could do graphing on, and it was just so exciting to do it. I don't know how much time we have, but I have a story about an admiral. This was part of the women's problem. The admiral came to it was an issue of another contract, and they wanted to show off the station, and they said, "Well, I would show them around," except. The day before, I was told to wear tight clothes to this presentation that I was giving at the equipment. And so I was supposed to have sexy clothes on. And then I showed them things, and you know, technically he did ask questions and stuff. And then I got feedback and they wanted to tell the admiral that they could save costs by using this type of equipment. And this, you know, the way we were doing things, we could optimize that for other projects. And they get, you know, have less people. And so the admiral's question was, but you're not going to let Sue go. You're going to keep Sue. And so I always remember that. And he was a nice guy, but this was the sign of the times.
Well, I'll give you a funny anecdote for a minute. There was two vice presidents of Grumman walking through the Lem data reduction station, seeing these computers. Their computer at one time, we had another one later. And one's talking to the other, says, "What is all this equipment for?" He says, "Oh, it's to reduce the data." He says, "Why the hell don't we just hire a whole bunch of mathematicians and fire them after it's over?" They didn't have comprehension of data.
I think it all comes down to the quantities of data that we were processing that just probably hadn't been done before.
But today it looks like nothing.
Well, today it's you contain with the big data today, but that when you have a leap like that, it becomes very, very difficult to adjust to the leap. But it was better for the young people because they didn't know any better.
So you guys are so inspiring to me.
But I mean, just a funny thing. There was an analog computer I used to pass by. No one. That's really old.
Yeah. No. You guys are both inspiring. Like I've been really lucky, and I became an engineer. I did software and hardware, and you know, managed people, and like I get so much amazing stuff from you two guys, and I think I'm just really lucky to have you guys. So
thank you
very much.
We're lucky to have you.
Thank you. Yes, you're good.
Yeah. I like you better than your sister. No, not really. I say that because you're here.